This is White Sox Weekly, your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and a drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago.
Now, here's your host, Jeff Mellor.
Good afternoon. Happy Saturday. I hope you're enjoying the pleasant weather here locally in Chicago. The White Sox are in Texas as we speak, getting set for game number 2 of 3 between the White Sox and Rangers. They lost the opener yesterday, 3-1. Do know that Mike Vassell will be on the mound to start the game today for the White Sox. Did not have clarity with that event initially, but I did mention on the post game last night that I would open the show and give you the starter, and it is going to be Mike Vassell on the mound, who's 3-2 with a 2.18 ERA today. He will be opposed by Jacob DeGrom. So we have ourselves a what could be a nice little pitching matchup, especially when you consider how well Vassell's pitched all season. We'll see how deep into the game he can go as he continues to get stretched out, but I would certainly anticipate if he can put up a few zeros, he will probably be out there at least 3, maybe 4, even 5 innings if he can get if he can be economical with his pitches. So that's what's in line for today. Vassell up against DeGrom as the White Sox try and win this series against the Rangers. If they're going to do that, they're going to have to take two in a row because they lost last night to the Rangers 3-1. That one was a bit of a buzzkill as the Rangers went with a bullpen game. And unfortunately, Sean Armstrong absolutely baffled the White Sox lineup. He was the opener. Probably only expected an inning, maybe two, but Bruce Bochy was able to lean on him for 3 scoreless frames. He struck out 5 White Sox hitters. The offense definitely did not have its best performance. In fact, I would say it was probably one of the worst White Sox efforts offensively in some time because they've been doing a really nice job of drawing walks. They've been amongst actually leading the league in walks over the past month or so. And so they've been excellent in that regard. Last night was not the way you wanted to go. But the big news from yesterday was not the fact that the White Sox lost or the fact that the offense wasn't up to snuff. The biggest issue or the biggest news of the day for the White Sox was the fact that we had ourselves a trade. That's right. We had ourselves a White Sox trade. Andrew Vaughn was dealt. Andrew Vaughn was dealt. There it is. Better late than never. Thank you, Jake. You know what? Behind the scenes, they're going to blame Tyler Aki and Shane Norling for coming in and disrupting the flow of the show. That's all right. I love those guys. They were obviously just on here locally on ESPN 1000, but they were coming in to say hello and goodbye to Brendan and Jake. So they were distracting. But Andrew Vaughn dealt yesterday for Aaron Civale. And that was the big news of the day. The White Sox finally closed the book on the number 3 overall pick, Andrew Vaughn. And we're going to talk with Keith Law later about 2 o'clock today. And I'm going to ask Keith if there's anything to be learned from the process, what went wrong with Andrew Vaughn and the White Sox. He will try and resurrect his career. And so I'll chat with him about 2 o'clock. But I want to bring in ESPN baseball reporter Jesse Rogers, who broke the Andrew Vaughn end of things. I should say the White Sox acquired Aaron Civale from the Brewers, and he will start tomorrow for the White Sox against the Rangers. But the White Sox do close the book on Andrew Vaughn. Jesse Rogers joins me right now on White Sox Weekly. Jess, I guess for White Sox fans, it was time to end the Andrew Vaughn era. Your initial thoughts on what they were able to do yesterday?
I mean, really, it was just moving on, as you just mentioned. I mean, that's basically it. I mean, the writing was on the wall. Really, at the end of last year, it was just a matter of when, not if. I think just like with Luis Robert, the team would have liked to see Vaughn do better and maybe flip him. I mean, obviously, they're moving on to a new era of White Sox baseball. We see all these young players making debuts, and Robert and Vaughn are not the future. It's just too bad that he continued to slide backwards, kind of like Luis Robert as well. I mean, he's a guy that hit 320 off fastballs just 2 years ago, 283 last year. That was below 200 this year. I mean, if you can't hit the fastball, you really don't belong in the major leagues. And that's probably half the reason he was sent down in the first place, Jeff. So it's just really just moving on to the next era of White Sox baseball. And we've seen this over the last couple of years. I mean, obviously Vaughn was left over from the previous regime. Chris Getz is kind of, you know, setting this tone, so to speak, with his own players, his own regime. And there was just no real future for Vaughn with the White Sox. So it was just a matter of when. And fortunately, they kind of had to trade him at his lowest point.
Yeah, and the way I look at it, you know, unfortunately for Andrew Vaughn, he still can be a salvageable piece for the Brewers. He can still go on to have a productive career. Part of the problem for him was when you're the third overall pick, there's some lofty expectations, right? And the reality of that is that sometimes that can weigh on you a little bit. The fan base will get anxious when you're not the savior for the roster. And in some ways, you've been covering baseball in this town for a long time now, Jess. You were around when the White Sox, the previous regime that drafted Andrew Vaughn and pushed him to the majors, perhaps prematurely, to play some outfield. Do you think that possibly disrupted Andrew Vaughn's ability to kind of progress and grow as a player?
I don't necessarily. I mean, he was putting up some decent numbers as he started his career. You know, obviously being surrounded by other good hitters helps as well. We've seen even Gavin Sheets move on to a better lineup around him and do some damage in San Diego. Maybe that'll happen here with Vaughn. I don't think his growth was stunted. I think that the White Sox, and maybe at least through the previous regime, had a problem developing players, especially position players. I think it's been pretty obvious that their pitching infrastructure has been better than their hitting infrastructure. I think time has shown that out. I don't think, like, the facts show, that's not even an opinion. I think the facts kind of point to that. So for whatever reason, they've had trouble developing players. And now you go through another rebuild. There's really no support system there. There's no help around him. There's no protection. And you know, so I don't think it's them rushing him. I just don't think they've developed position players well. I don't know if another year in the minors would have made a difference in his career or not. But this is all stuff we can't go back and replay it in a different, you know, different version of his career. I the other thing is also you have to put a lot of blame on the player. I was talking to a scout after he was sent down. He said, look, this guy's given away way too many at-bats, putting himself in bad counts, chasing too much. You know, he had, I think, his highest chase rate yet this year. And, of course, wasn't hitting fastballs. So you also have to put it on the player, not just the team around him.
No, I think there's something to that. Jesse Rogers joining me here on White Sox Weekly. And if you look, you know, for whatever it's been now, 2-3 weeks that he's been down in Charlotte, there really hasn't been any noticeable difference. And you certainly would expect just by the fact that he's going down a level that there should be some success. But the reality is it really hasn't come for him. So, you know, there was very few reasons for the White Sox to believe that he could turn this thing around quickly. And so I will at least commend the White Sox front office for pouncing in a situation where, I'm not going to lie, I on Thursday I was doing a lot of monitoring what was going on with Jacob Mizorowski, the Brewers phenom, the young phenom who came up and made his debut, hit triple digits 13 times in his debut, topping out at 102.2. So clearly they wanted to find a spot for him in their rotation. Aaron Civale is somebody who is going to be a free agent at the end of the season. And so you can understand why in his walk year he wants to be making starts and trying to boost his value come free agency. What do you think, or what, I guess from talking around baseball, what have the White Sox gotten in Aaron Civale here?
Yeah, I've watched him up close a few times in person and stuff like that. There's, to me, it's not a lot of deception to him from the times I've watched him. And if you dig in some of the numbers, I mean, he's fastball, sinker, cutter. He plays off the fastball. I think his cutter's his best pitch, although the numbers don't look good this year. I don't think there's a lot of deception. He has experience. He's had good moments. He's had good enough years. He came from a good pitching organization. He's been on several good pitching. So I think there's something in there, and I think he'll be able to just relax and pitch. And obviously free agency's on his mind. That's why he requested the trade. I'm sure there were some quasi promises made when he went to Milwaukee. Hey, we're going to let you start, and then They had they just have a ton of good pitchers that were hurt, which allowed him to start, and now these pitchers are either coming up or getting healthy. You know, they don't even have Woodruff back. So, look, I think if he just gets some outs, you know, he'll be more productive than what Andrew Vaughn was doing down in the minors, right?
No doubt.
And then maybe they flip him, maybe they don't, who knows, but he's a solid veteran who's been around the block, but I'm not sure he's pitching at his best right now. But I don't feel like he's one of these great, I'm going to deceive you guys. He'll fill up the zone. He's got to be, you know, not perfect, but he's got to be very well placed with his fastball and his cutter to get the outs. So we'll see. Yeah. Obviously, it's a flyer for the White Sox, just like the Brewers are taking a flyer with Andrew Vaughn.
Well, and from their perspective, with the opening with, you know, the injury to Perez and, of course, Jonathan Cannon dealing with his own lower back issue, it certainly made sense with some innings available to try and go ahead and pounce. So you're right. I think it's certainly possible if Savale does anything where he's productive over the next 4 weeks, he certainly could be somebody that the White Sox are shopping at the trade deadline yet again. In addition to Adrian Hauser, who didn't have his best outing last night, but actually battled through some illness. So the fact that he was able to take the mound yesterday, I think, was something that the White Sox were appreciative of because he was dealing with an illness. But he got through five, wasn't his best start. The first time he actually hasn't given the White Sox a quality start. Is there any conversations around the league that in an interest in Adrian Hauser as a possible trade deadline arm acquisition?
You know, not any more than anyone else.
Okay.
He's not an October pitcher, right? He's a back end of the rotation guy that I think is certainly a depth guy that if he continues to pitch well, will get moved, to be honest, sometime next month. But that could be like the day of the deadline. You know, it's just like, hey, we need another arm. I haven't talked to anybody that's like, oh my God, I got to have Adrian Hauser, right? No offense. I'm just saying like, he's a nice depth piece that the Sox picked up and might flip for a C prospect or something like that. Now, again, if he puts up another month, like he did the first few starts, that'll open some more eyes. So, but there's a lot of back end guys that'll become available very late in the process. And I expect Hauser would be one of them. By the way, let me say one more thing about Vaughn. The Brewers are always thinking about the future because of the situation they're in with their payroll. And I believe Reese Hoskins is a free agent. Like, I could absolutely see them trying to fix Vaughn enough, and then he becomes their first baseman.
Sure.
Like, that's what they're always thinking about the next thing. Now, I don't know if they can fix Vaughn, but maybe the change of scenery alone will do it. But Milwaukee's always a team that's looking for offense because they can't pay for it, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
So it's not out of the realm of possibility that he's playing first base for them at some point if Hoskins moves on, but they've got to fix him first. So that's the flyer they're taking,
sure.
where the Sox are taking a flyer now because of the injuries you mentioned, and then the ability to maybe flip Savale as well next month.
Yeah, I think it's one of those, you know, it's a challenge trade. The White Sox at this point, you know, didn't see a whole lot of future with Andrew Vaughn, and, you know, like, yeah, the asset that Savale could be at the deadline could be more beneficial to them. So, yeah, you laid it out right. The extra year of control for Andrew Vaughn certainly made it more appealing for the Brewers there. Another moment here with Jesse Rogers on White Sox Weekly. You did mention Luis Robert Jr.'s name earlier, and he's somebody who he's still playing a Gold Glove caliber defense. And whenever he does get on the bases, he is certainly somebody who commands attention when he's on the base pass. But of course, the hitting has not been anywhere near what the White Sox would have hoped, and certainly probably not enough to garner some real interest on the trade market. Now, I was having some conversations, and I think it's a fair discussion, Jess. He has an option. He has two team options left after this year, both for about $20 million. And it's not cost prohibitive. It's not obviously the amount you would want to spend on a player who's not productive. But if the White Sox are just not getting bowled over by any of the offers that they get at the trade deadline, is it possible that they, in the offseason, pick up the team option and keep him here for another year?
More.
Stream the games live on the ESPN Chicago app.
White Sox fans, join us for $5 Tuesdays. All fans will enjoy a specially priced $5 concessions menu, including draft beers from Miller Lite or Modelo, Garrett Popcorn, Stadium Buttery, Vienna Beef Hot Dogs or Polish Sausages, Beggar's Pizza Slices, Nachos, and select Coca-Cola products. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/Tuesdays. Come on out Tuesday against the Cardinals as they're in town to play the White Sox. All right, I mentioned the White Sox made a few roster moves prior to today's game in Texas. They did add Aaron Civale to the active roster. He will start tomorrow. Again, Mike Vassell is going to take the rock for the White Sox and start against Jacob DeGrom today. The White Sox did recall Ryan Noda from Class AAA Charlotte. They claimed him off of waivers yesterday, and now they have activated him. They also optioned Tim Elko and Tyler Gilbert to Charlotte. Gilbert was activated yesterday, pitched yesterday. Elko optioned as well. That's obviously, I think, for White Sox fans, the bigger news. Elko has really struggled. Even though he's got 4 home runs in 18 games, he was striking out a lot lately, and he's only hitting 155. So going to have to make a little more contact if he's going to be able to stick in the majors. I know he's somebody who White Sox fans were, at least at the beginning of the season, as he had a really nice spring training and he crushed it in AAA throughout pretty much all of April and May. And so White Sox fans were kind of champing at the bit to see him. Well, they've seen him for a little bit now, and he still has to get around to making a little bit more contact if he's going to succeed in the majors. I did want to share with you Len Casper, our very own, the voice of the White Sox, along with Darren Jackson. You'll be hearing him later in the pregame show with White Sox skipper Will Venable, and then right around 3 o'clock before the White Sox and Rangers have a 3:05 first pitch today. So Len's going to be joining us during the pregame coverage. But he had a fun conversation with Waddle and Sylvie yesterday on ESPN 1000, and I wanted to share some of it with you because I thought it was a good big picture breakdown of where the White Sox organization is at these days.
What do you see in the last year, led by Chris Getz, with a pitching support system that they've gotten more out of guys that they've brought in and they've been able to resuscitate their careers? You mentioned Hauser. He's another good example. They had a few guys last year to do the same thing. What are they tangibly doing differently in the last year or two that maybe they weren't doing in prior years?
Well, you know, obviously scouting is really important. I think the focus for Chris when he took over was we're going to really dig in hard on the pitching side of it. And, you know, the hitting stuff will get there. And, you know, when you look at what they had on the roster when Chris took over, they still had Moncada, Eloy, Vaughn. You know, Tim Anderson was kind of here at the end when Chris took over. So they kind of were locked into some guys. Andrew Benintendi in the middle of a long contract, Luis Robert Jr. But the pitching side, they had kind of, that was the area where I think they could really dig in and try to change things up. I think the addition of Brian Bannister has been huge. He and Ethan Katz have done some great work here. They took Hagen Smith, first-round pick last year. He and Noah Schultz might be the two top left-handed prospects in baseball. And then the two Rule 5 kids, man, they've been the two best pitchers on this roster, and it almost never happens that way. I can't think of another example of someone going in the Rule 5 draft and immediately joins a starting rotation to begin the year. And Shane Smith will likely be an all-star. So that is a big win for the White Sox. And it starts to now make you think that Grant Taylor, who throws 102, they might not need him to be a starter down the road. It's possible he could do it, but he could end up being the next Mason Miller in the ninth inning.
Len, we always talk about the importance of managers and just what kind of impact they have on a team over the course of a season. I'll ask you that about Will Venable. What impact has he had on this White Sox team in his first year as their manager?
Well, it's been huge. I just talked to him today about he was with the Cubs, then he was with Boston, then he went to Texas, and now he's with the White Sox. And that's all happened over the last 6 seasons. So, you know, he brings in a lot of outside knowledge from not only where he has been, but also back to his playing days in the major leagues. I knew Will when he was a coach on Joe Maddon's staff, and I thought he would do a good job. But until that person, even if he's your best friend, until they have that job, you just don't know how it's going to go because it's not easy. He has far overachieved already, in my opinion. He's very curious. He understands the things they need to fix. And I told him this the other day, and I think it was in an interview he did with James Fegan. This is Will Venable in a nutshell. You ask him a question about something that maybe didn't go right the day before, and his answer is, yep, we messed it up. And by the end of the sentence, he says, and we're going to fix it. Right. So there's a realism that he has, that he understood coming in that there was stuff that needed to be fixed. But his job and the staff's job is to fix it. And I think anyone who's watched this team with any regularity can see that this team plays a much better brand of baseball than they did last year. Mm-hmm. The addition of Mydroth and Caro and Miguel Vargas has just blossomed personality-wise and is having a really good year on both ends defensively and certainly with the bat. So you're starting to see a little bit of that core developing here, and it's been really fun. Kyle Teal is off to an interesting start, too. Real energetics, taking a lot of walks.
And that's what I was going to say. Like, some may be listening to this who aren't really in on the White Sox or haven't watched them on a daily basis or listened to you guys. And they say, well, the record, I mean.
The record's bad.
Yeah,
the record is bad, but they're 4-17 in one-run games, so. Yeah. That's also part of it, right? They've been in way more games than they were last year.
And that's what I was going to ask you, Len. You've had your eyes on it for every single out of the year. So what do you see, like, other than what you just said about those players that you mentioned? We love Mydroth, too. But, like, how far have they come, and how much further do they still need to go to become, you know, a solid team?
Right. Well, I think they have come a long way. And they do have a long way to go. I think everybody here acknowledges that. And I think the next wave, right, is you've got Colson Montgomery, who hasn't gotten here yet. You would hope he would be here at some point this season. Braden Montgomery is a switch-hitting outfielder, another acquisition in the Garrett Crochet trade. So two more position players, and then kind of see how it looks around the diamond. And then the two left-handed fireballers, Schultz and Hagen Smith. That really changes the math. And I don't know when they're all going to get here, but I would hope by this time next year that this team is even more competitive than it is this season. I don't think I'm speaking out of line by not promising anything the next couple of years, but you definitely see that the trajectory is up. But a fan said, I actually looked at the wild card standings because we're playing so well. And so when you hear stuff like that, it just feels a little different, right?
Yes, I've heard people actually talk about the wild card standings as well, which I had to put a little bit of throw a little of cold water on that. I said, let's move ahead of a couple teams and not have the worst record in the American League before we start keeping our eyes on the wild card standings. I don't want to yuck your yum, but at the same time, I'm a little bit more realistic. Len did mention Noah Schultz. I do want to mention Noah Schultz has been promoted to AAA Charlotte. So the White Sox 2022 first-round draft pick has now been elevated from AA Birmingham up to AAA Charlotte. So Len said he doesn't know when Schultz and Hagen Smith are going to arrive. Well, Noah Schultz is one step closer to arriving at Wright Field at 35th and Shields. Before we take a quick timeout and let you hear from White Sox starting pitcher Davis Martin, let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTVC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. When we come back, we will have a conversation with White Sox starting pitcher Davis Martin right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Waddle and Sylvie, weekdays, 2:30 to 6:30, ESPN Chicago.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. I'm Jeff Meller, getting you set for a full day of White Sox action here on the home of the White Sox, ESPN 1000. White Sox and Rangers, game number 2 of 3, coming your way this afternoon. It'll be Mike Vassell up against Jacob deGrom, as the White Sox will need to win 2 in a row if they're going to take this series and finish off with a 500 road trip before coming home and taking on the Cardinals for 3 at Wright Field on Tuesday. Hey, Sox fans, take advantage of one of our best offers this season. Get one ticket and 2 beers to select games starting at $19 with Miller Lite Baseball and Brews. You must be 21 and over with a valid ID. Includes all fees. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/brews. All right, can't wait. Have a conversation with this man, White Sox starting pitcher Davis Martin, who has really had quite a bit of success this season. Granted, maybe his last start wasn't his best, but it was still a good one nonetheless, even though the result didn't necessarily go your way, Davis. But I want to start. You're a Texas native, my man, and do you get just a little bit of extra juice going back and having a chance to start, whether it be in Texas or Houston? Do you get that extra juice going home and finally getting a chance to start a game in Texas?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I talked about it with my wife. I was like, I haven't pitched on Texas soil since the college super regional in 2018. So definitely has been way too long for me. So yeah, it was definitely had some added nerves, some added stuff going into it, but it was a lot of fun.
So for those who don't know, Davis Martin joining me here on White Sox Weekly is from Abilene, Texas. You went to Texas Tech, Davis. Who'd you grow up rooting for team-wise?
So I was a Rangers fan. I mean, that was the prime 2010, 2012 Rangers teams that were really good. So my dad and I would always watch them. The Rangers game was the first stadium I ever went to at the ballpark at Arlington. So being able to drive by that today, even though we're going to the new Globe Life Park, you know, it was a really cool, surreal moment being like, oh my gosh, like we're here. We're where we watched all those years ago.
That is funny. That's got to be like, you know, a dream come true moment in some ways. Obviously, you know, you're seeing it firsthand, all the kids who have been called up so far this season on your team, their dreams coming true with that, you know, that first major league call up and that first game. But these little things for you too, these, you know, these markers where you get to come home and finally pitch, you know, it's been a bit of a journey for you, but that has to be so cool.
Yeah, it's been awesome. And to be able to share with my family, they've been able to come to both series. So it's been a lot of fun. And yeah, you know, it's fun to see these guys see new places, but you know, some of the guys that have been around have also seen new places for the first time. So it is cool to kind of take that 1 second and kind of soak it all in.
Jeff Miller here on ESPN 1000, joined by White Sox starter Davis Martin on White Sox Weekly. Davis, what's been working for you so far this year? You're having a lot of success. You've already hit a career high in innings pitched in the majors. How do you feel about how your season's been so far?
Yeah, it's been good. I think there's been some really bright spots. You know, I think there's definitely some stuff that we can refine and get better at. You know, but this year so far, for just going out and having, you know, four or five pitches I can throw for a strike every outing has been really great. It's something that I can rely on, can give different looks and different counts. And, you know, having guys like Martin Perez on the team to, you know, kind of take me through, you know, how to work an AB, how to use different pitches in different situations to get deeper into games. And you know, it doesn't have to be the sexy strikeout to get to six innings and or six plus innings. So it's been like a group effort. It's been, you know, it's been good.
I love hearing that, Davis. If you don't mind, bring me a little bit more inside, because fans who are listening here, you know, somebody say, oh, this veteran pitcher on the roster has helped me a little bit here. But Martin Perez, you mentioned, I still see him in the clubhouse. He's dealing with his injury. But, you know, somebody who's a veteran who can help you guys out, help the young staff out. Like, what's a little piece of insight that maybe he's given you or some of the other pitchers on the staff that you didn't know before you met him?
Yeah, I mean, you watch him those first few outings that he had, and you're just kind of in awe with his arsenal. And, you know, he'd be the first one to tell you he doesn't throw really hard, but, you know, he does a really good job of giving different looks, giving different shapes with pitches in different spots, and, you know, sometimes different pitches with different shapes in the same spot, you know. So, you know, with a guy like me where I have sinker, slider, four-seam, changeup, all kind of playing off of each other, you know, he sits there and goes, yeah, you can do this to this spot, and then you can come off of it with this spot, see how he reacts with this pitch. If he reacts this way, you can go this direction. If he reacts that way, you can go this direction. And, you know, he does a really good job of kind of simplifying, you know, what we're seeing on the field. And because that's the thing, is it's a game of adjustments, and the faster that you can adjust to the hitter, you know, you can stay one step ahead. And he's been a key role in a lot of our success.
I love that. Davis Martin joining me here on White Sox Weekly. So, because it's not just the pitching coach, it's not just the individual pitcher. You're absolutely right in the sense that when you have a team that's pitching well, it takes an entire village, in a sense, to help the team maximize everything they have. So I love hearing that. What has it been like for you working with Brian Bannister and Ethan Katz and Martin Perez and just others? Like, what has kind of worked for you working with the White Sox pitching organization as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously, you know, Banny and Katz gave me a kick change last year, and that probably prolonged my career by a good margin, just giving an offering to the left-handed hitters that I've never had before. So in that aspect, it's been great. But, you know, this staff, you know, I know we're young, but we do a really good job of not only being there for each other, you know, seeing what guys are seeing when they throw, bringing that information to us after the game if we're throwing against that same team, and then just the overall competition between all the young guys and their starting rotation. You know, one guy goes out there, goes 7-2. You know, the next guy's like, well, I got to do better than that. Let's go. And so it just kind of keeps the constant competition, not only against the team out there, but in your own locker room. And that constant competition, I think, is a great marker for us and keeps everybody hungry to be better.
Okay, so let's drill down a little bit on that, because I talked with Adrian Hauser about a week or so ago, and he was telling me about his relationship with you, getting to know you. You guys both worked, I believe it's Pitching Works in Oklahoma, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so he talked about just having a relationship with you. I have to, so in the offseason, you're at Pitching Works, you're working on your stuff. Adrian Hauser's there, you're getting to know him a little bit. I mean, what was it like when were you actually actively recruiting him to come and join you guys with the White Sox? How did that come about? Because obviously he opted out and had the opportunity to sign, and he chose the White Sox. So what was that like for you?
Yeah, I mean, he had a connection with, Walker, mm-hmm. with the Brewers, and, you know, I had some conversations with Walker and asked how Adrian was doing in the offseason, and, you know, it was just like, he's a great dude. He works his ass off. He's got incredible stuff. You know, Pitching Works out there, Alex Marnie did a great job with him this offseason, making some key adjustments, and, you know, with an uptick in velo and some added arsenal, pitches to his arsenal, it's, the guy was a different pitcher. And so, you know, always love to have a Pitching Works guy and Adrian come out here. You know, we've gotten closer over the last few years in the off seasons working out together. So it's great to have him in the day-to-day stuff.
All right. So you mentioned the Brewers connection for Walker and Hauser. You guys just added Aaron Civale. Do you have any scouting report or relationship with Aaron Civale, who will be joining your team and starting tomorrow, apparently?
No, I actually just introduced myself to him today. So we'll do a lot of work on the bench today during the game to, you know, kind of catch up and meet each other. So it'll be good.
No, that's cool. Davis Martin joining me here on White Sox Weekly. Okay, so what's it like working with two rookie catchers now, both very talented players, but also something that, and it's funny I'm going to say this, Davis, but a veteran pitcher like you, because in the blink of an eye, you go from, you know, being in the locker room for a couple of seasons to all of a sudden you're one of the vets, the savvy vets there. What's it been like working with a couple of rookie catchers?
Yeah, I mean, it's been good. I think they have a good rotation to work with. I think all the guys in our rotation have a really good understanding of what they want to do and how they want to attack hitters. You know, so having those conversations pregame with those guys, they're very receptive. They learn quickly. They ask the right questions, and all it is game reps. The more game reps we can get, the better. And, you know, I think a perfect example, this past outing against the Astros, you know, we have our last guy up, Brendan Rodgers, and we have some good, you know, swing and misses up the top. We got a good swing and miss on the slider away. And, you know, my gut was saying like, oh, I want to go this pitch here, and Cube is back there. It shook me off twice and called his own pitch, and we end up getting him to pop up, and we come back in, and both the pitching coach and the catching coach are like, yeah, we agree with Q made the right decision. And, you know, I punched Q in the chest. I said, look at you growing up. And so, you know, that's the thing. It's like, the longer we get to work together, the longer we get to, you know, experience those outings, experience situations together, we start getting that trust and building that trust. And it's only going to get better as time goes on.
Love hearing that. Davis Martin joining me for another couple minutes here on White Sox Weekly. So I'm curious, Davis, your entire career in the majors, PitchCom has been in effect, but what has it been like using that system and working with someone like you or Kyle Teal, having that ability to maybe streamline the process as a pitcher and a catcher?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, having the PitchCom on the glove is, you know, I think younger pitchers and older catcher, it's usually the older catcher will start it and kind of guide you through the AB. And then I think right now it's, you know, the inverse is like you have some of the starters with their own pitch comms kind of starting the AB in which direction they want to go and letting the catcher kind of see how the AB progresses and, you know, see which direction we want to go. And it's just great because you can get into a good rhythm. You can go, you don't have to shake multiple times if you want to get to a pitch that you want to get to, you know, and like I said, with Teal in his first outing, you know, by the end of the game, he's giving me suggestions that I want already. So now we're on the same page because he's got, you know, 60, 70, 80 pitches seeing me going through the outing saying like, okay, this is what he wants to do in this situation. So it's great. I think it advances the learning curve so much faster and allows us to have a really good rhythm and learn each other quickly.
You're having a lot of great success so far this year, Davis, as a starter. Maybe the only guy on your staff who's having a better year is Shane Smith, the Rule 5 pick. Have you been surprised and impressed by what he's been able to do in his first season in the majors?
Surprised, no. Impressed, very much so. You know, I think you look at what he did in camp and, you know, the stuff that he had in camp, you know, this is not a surprise to me at all. You know, but I'm very impressed with how he handles himself as a professional. And, you know, it's been good because, like I said, we have a younger staff and we don't have anybody who's crazy, you know, tons of service time. So we're all kind of still learning this stuff together. And I think it's a great, it's great because we all feed off each other. We talk smack to each other. We pick each other up when we have a bad outing. And, you know, Shane's just consistent. You know, you look at his routine, his work ethic, like I said, is just constantly consistent. Like, he's not getting too high, he's not getting too low, he constantly wants to get better, he's asking questions, you know, we're asking him questions about what stuff he's seeing. And so, you know, it's been really incredible, and you know, I think the sky's the limit for him.
Speaking of great stuff, he's only been here for two games, but Grant Taylor, your thoughts on what he brings to the table? I know Bannister's called his stuff electric.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I joked about it with somebody when Saquon Barkley did the reverse hurdle. Uh-huh. You know, you see the entire Eagles sideline kind of just like stand up and stare. And, you know, when Grant Taylor took the mound, you see everybody in the dugout get off the bench, get off the iPads, get off of everything, and just locked into the game because you don't see that kind of stuff every day. And that's in the big league level. So it's a very impressive arsenal, and just another guy who keeps his head down. He works hard. He doesn't get too high, and just, yeah, great stuff. It's incredible.
Davis Martin for one more here on White Sox Weekly. So I know the record obviously doesn't reflect what you guys have wanted, but you certainly, at least watching it day in and day out, it definitely feels like the team is moving in the right direction. Is the clubhouse, the feeling inside the clubhouse different than last year?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's very much of a confidence of you know, we're going out and we're here to win. You know, we're coming to the field expecting to win, you know, and I think the product, you know, obviously the results haven't shown, but I think the product over the course of nine innings is, you know, much better than it was last year. And I think it's something that White Sox fans could be proud of. You know, we're very gritty. We don't give up. We're playing 27 outs every night, regardless of the situation. So, you know, I definitely think it's something to build off of. I think there's still a lot of room to grow and a lot of room for some execution. But, you know, over the course of the season, I think it's something that really good foundation to start out at.
Well, Davis, I will tell you that as a White Sox fan watching each and every pitch, it definitely feels like the attitude is different, and on a night in and night out basis, even though the wins haven't been coming as much as I know you guys would like, it certainly feels like everything is moving in the right direction. So keep on doing what you guys are doing. I'm sure the success will follow very soon. It's been a fun watch so far this season. So thanks for hopping on this afternoon, man.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That is Davis Martin, again, White Sox starter, having a lot of success this year already with a career-high 80 and two-thirds innings pitched and a lot of quality starts to boot. It has been fun to watch him so far this year. White Sox fans, enter the Ultimate Fan Sweepstakes for your chance to win an exclusive City Connect package. One lucky fan will receive some of the best City Connect gear, including a jersey, sweat, shirt, and more. To enter, visit whitesox.com/sweepstakes. When we come back, the trade of Andrew Vaughn actually sent me down a rabbit hole, rediscovering some of the roster transactions that the White Sox made to acquire a lot of the key pieces on the 2005 World Series winning team. Of course, we've been doing a lot of retrospective with that so far this season, and part of the reason is because you have a lot of interesting things with the celebration of the 20-year anniversary coming your way. So we're going to look back just a little bit on some of the key pieces that the White Sox added through trade in 2005, or at least on that 2005 roster. We had a fun Twitter poll question yesterday that we asked White Sox fans regarding this, so I'll share that with you. Plenty to come right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
It's simple. The ESPN Chicago app.
Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. White Sox fans, enter the Ultimate Fan Sweepstakes for your chance to win an exclusive City Connect package. One lucky fan will receive some of the best City Connect gear, including a jersey, sweatshirt, and more. To enter, visit whitesox.com/sweepstakes. So yesterday, spurred on by the trade of Andrew Vaughn, we asked a White Sox Twitter question because I went through a bit of a – I went into a rabbit hole to find some of the best White Sox trades in franchise history. And it led me to all of a sudden to discover that a lot of the best White Sox trades made resulted in that 2005 World Series winning roster. So the poll question, I'll give it to you. Specifically, we removed Paul Konerko because, honestly, Paulie, fan favorite, probably going to run away and win in a landslide. And also, we're limited to four options on the old Twitter poll on X. So we removed Paul Konerko for Mike Cameron. And yes, if you forgot, Paul Konerko was acquired from the Reds back in 1998 for Mike Cameron. And the interesting thing was that wasn't the first time that Konerko was traded. Remember, he started as a Dodgers prospect before he was traded to the Reds. And then ultimately, the White Sox acquired him for Mike Cameron on November 11th, 1998. Konerko would go on to hit 439 home runs and have 1,412 RBIs. And, of course, as you know, would have number 14 retired in the concourse, statue of his likeness, all this great stuff, Paulie, as Hawk would say. And, of course, now the Pope is Pope Leo XIV to honor Paul Konerko. Okay, that last part's not true, but obviously, oh, yeah, by the way, did you see the Pope wearing the Sox hat this week? He was in Vatican City, and a fan brought Pope Leo, a White Sox fan, as he was meeting him, and the Pope donned the White Sox cap. I'm sure you've probably seen it by now, but if you haven't, go ahead and seek it out. It's just, what a world we're living in when the Pope in full garb is also sporting a White Sox hat. You have to love it as a Sox fan. Anyway, I digress. So we took the Paul Konerko trade out of the mix because we figured he'd probably run away and win in a landslide. But that doesn't mean that there weren't four other fantastic options to choose from. And I'll start with the one that I think is near and dear to a lot of White Sox fans' hearts because it came at the expense of Cubs fans. And that, of course, was the acquisition of John Garland for Matt Kirschner, which occurred in 1998 as well, just as the Konerko trade happened. This one actually happened a little bit earlier. It was a trade deadline deal, July 29th, 1998. The Cubs were in contention for the postseason, and they needed some reliever help. And so they acquired Matt Kirschner from the White Sox. And in return, the White Sox would add John Garland, who would basically solidify the rotation for nearly a decade on the South Side and, of course, be one of those key starters in that historic playoff run that the White Sox had in 2005, where they were just dominating, only one loss during that postseason run in 2005. So John Garland was one of the options. Of course, the igniter to the 2005 offense, Scott Podsednik, who was acquired from the Brewers in a deal where the White Sox also did receive Luis Vizcaíno and a player to be named later at the time, which ultimately would go on to be Travis Hinton, someone who the White Sox fans would not really become familiar with. But Scotty Pods and Luis Vizcaíno were added by the White Sox in exchange for Carlos Lee in December of 2004. And part of the thought process by both Kenny Williams and Ozzie Guillen was that the White Sox needed to reshape the roster a little bit. Remember, that was during the heyday of the Piranhas, the old Minnesota Twins team that was always nagging Ozzie Guillen, and he wanted a team that could be more than just a one-dimensional power-hitting team. And so that is why Carlos Lee ended up being moved to Milwaukee, where, by the way, Carlos Lee went on to have an extremely productive career, and I think you could certainly make the argument that the Brewers were happy with their side of that deal. So maybe, just maybe, we'll have part due here with the Brewers and White Sox in their deal of Andrew Vaughn for Aaron Civale. But Carlos Lee was dealt to the Brewers in 2004, the winter of 2004, and Scotty Pods would obviously go on to hit that game two, that World Series game two home run, which will live on in White Sox lore forever. And of course, over 50 stolen bases. I think he had 59 that year in 2005. Was really the igniter to that offense, giving Ozzie Guillen more than just, you know, station to station baseball that he could rely upon to have somebody at the top of the lineup who could get on and steal a base. Again, back in 2005, when stealing bases was much harder than it is nowadays with the new rules. So that was one of the options. And then finally, we threw on the Jose Contreras and cash in exchange for Esteban Loaiza, which the White Sox also acquired as a trade deadline deal back in 2004. Remember, Esteban Loaiza had finished as the American League Cy Young runner-up in 2003 when he won, I believe, 21 games. But in 2004, after that sensational season, which he almost single-handedly tried to carry the White Sox to the playoffs that year by himself, he had some regression, was not the same pitcher in 04. And so at the deadline, Jose Contreras was struggling for the Yankees as well. And so in a classic challenge trade, the White Sox ended up flipping Loaiza for Jose Contreras, who then would go on for about the next, 18 months to have an absurd run for the White Sox, where for my money, there was a 12-month stretch, a calendar year, where I thought Jose Contreras was the most dominant pitcher in the American League from essentially, you know, around the middle of 2005 up until the middle of 2006. I'll pull up the numbers and I'll do a little number cruncher for you and get them for you. But he was, for that stretch run, was unbelievable. And I never felt so confident as a White Sox fan in a starter, at least I'd say in the last 20 years, when a guy was taking the mound. I always felt like Jose Contreras for that stretch run was going to win baseball games for the White Sox. And he obviously also was huge in the White Sox playoff run. So those were the options that we gave White Sox fans as a result of the Andrew Vaughn trade yesterday. And the runaway winner yesterday was Scott Pocednik being acquired. He got 36% of the votes. The Freddie Garcia trade? I think I omitted that one as I was running through. The White Sox also acquired Freddie Garcia from the Seattle Mariners in exchange for Miguel Olivo, Jeremy Reed, and Mike Morse. Of course, Freddie Garcia, another key piece in that rotation. So think about it. Of the four options that we gave you, three of them were starters on that five-man rotation that the White Sox had that ended up winning the World Series. So, and, you know, along with Mark Burley, those were your four horses for the most part that really led the way for that 2005 championship run. And three of them were added via trade. Just crazy when you think back about it on how the White Sox were able to assemble that roster. So, yes, Freddie Garcia garnered 23% of the votes. The Jose Contreras pickup was 22%. And then John Garland, I'm actually a little surprised that only picked up 19% of the votes, because I do know that White Sox fans oftentimes do like to kind of stick their finger in the eye of Cubs fans. And that always is a little bit extra bump. But I guess it's probably just because Contreras was so dominant. Sweaty Freddy, remember, always sweating on the mound, but usually pitching the White Sox to victory. And then, of course, the igniter of the offense, Scotty Pods, was the winner of yesterday's White Sox Twitter poll question. All right, up next, we are going to shift gears a little bit because Ray Durham just had his bobblehead day at Wright Field this past Sunday, and he joined Len Casper and Darren Jackson in the booth, and it was a fun conversation, a good trip down memory lane. So we're going to re-rack that for you when we come back. Be here on Friday, June 27th, to see artist Flo Rida perform a post-game concert presented by Coca-Cola after the White Sox take on the Giants at 6:40. Don't miss your chance at an up-close on-field experience. Exclusive on-field passes are on sale now with limited availability. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/concert. When we come back, we'll let you hear Ray Durham in the booth with Len and DJ right here on White Sox Weekly on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Visit whitesox.com/promos. I mentioned bobbleheads. Ray Durham was in the house this past Sunday as the White Sox were taking on the Royals, and he was in attendance because it was his first ever bobblehead day. He mentions this with Len and DJ as he was in the booth. It was a fun conversation, so we're going to re-rack it for you and let you hear Ray Durham in the booth with Len Casper and Darren Jackson this past Sunday.
Well, one of the things I just asked Ray, well, first of all, it's great to see you, my friend. It's been so long.
Too long.
And you were shocked to see I was still here, weren't you? Like, what the hell? DJ's still here? Go ahead. You can answer.
You're great at what you do.
Thank you. That's you know what? You can stay the rest of the game.
Well said. You know what? I'll ask the question. So you played with DJ, and then he was a broadcaster. Did he change?
No.
He didn't?
No, he didn't change.
That's good. That's good.
DJ is DJ.
Right.
You know, why change who you are? Because you change positions.
That's it.
You know, what's interesting about that is 1994 is my first year with the White Sox, and Ray was in big league camp, and I remember it distinctly. He was not with our team that year in 94, but he was so close to getting there, and he was such a good kid and had so much talent. And you're looking at this little 5'8 guy going, this guy hits the ball farther than I do. What the heck? He weighs 160 pounds. You know, that's what's amazing to me, Ray. The part of your game that's, I don't know if it's underappreciated, but the things that you accomplished as a switch hitting second baseman, plenty of power, delivered in the clutch, lots of runs batted in, stole bases. Do you understand you're a premier elite second baseman in the history of the game? You've not changed either. You've always been the same person. But do you ever look at your career like, you know what? Yeah, I was pretty elite.
You know what? I don't, but like other people do. Like my wife all the time. You know you did this, did that. I'm like, no, I really didn't do it for numbers. I did it because I loved the game, and you know, I didn't want to let my teammates down. I think that was the biggest thing. I mean, I wanted to do my job, what was asked of me to do, and not to let my teammates down.
273 steals, 192 home runs, career on-base percentage of .352. So on-base percentage now is the first thing people talk about. It was batting average when you came up, but you took your walks. Did that matter to you? Was that something you sought out, or was it simply just don't swing at bad pitches?
Well, I wanted to get on base in front of the big bats, because that was my job. I mean, I was a leadoff guy, you know, tried to stay gap to gap and hit the ball on the ground and use my speed.
Well, you scored over 100 runs, 97, 98, 99, 2000, 2001, 2002.
Yep. A lot of years.
1,249 runs.
Yep.
That's what it's about, right? Over 2,000 career hits. About scoring runs.
I mean, that was the name of the game. I mean, if you were one run better than the opposition, no, you did good.
How about this? How many bobbleheads have you had, Ray? Officially, go ahead and say it.
One.
Today's. Yeah, I thought about that before you got in here. I'm like, going, this has got to be about probably the third time at least that he's had a bobblehead. He probably had one out with the Giants. They did Ray Durham Day. The White Sox, as he was a premier elite leadoff guy for us. And to hear that, I was shocked. You know, not like you're pursuing that.
Oh, no, not at all. But, I mean, if they give it out, I mean, I'll take it.
And a recent topic on and off the air that we have discussed is switch hitting. And one topic is there are a lot of guys who switch hit, but they're clearly better from one side versus the other. A handful of guys decide to scrap switch hitting, fouled by India. But you were one of the rare guys. Chipper Jones was like this. You were the same guy, right-handed, left-handed. Your batting average, 2-point difference, 9-point difference in the OBP. You slugged the same. You had to be very proud of that because it's really hard to maintain one swing, let alone two.
No, it was I made sure and practiced both sides of the, you know, hitting because I didn't want to let one side, you know, dictate what I did on the other side or the opposition, you know, well, we're going to turn them around and let them hit from the weaker side.
Right.
So I didn't want that. So I worked on religiously on both sides.
You went 2-for-9 with a double and two walks, right versus right. I would imagine all or most of those were against knuckleballers.
Yes, that would probably be Wakefield.
We've seen that. So give us the theory on why you hit right against a knuckleballer. You weren't the only one.
Was your natural side right-handed?
Yeah, natural side
was
right-handed.
Luis Castillo did the same thing against the knuckleballers. Bobby Witt Jr. at the plate. And he swings and misses. So any thoughts on why you went right?
You know, it was, I guess maybe I could see, pick up the ball better. I mean, because that ball is all over the place.
Right. And we don't see any knuckleballers now.
Right.
Which is really interesting.
I mean, knuckleballs, I think it's a weapon for a pitcher. I mean, because then you can throw the knuckleball and, you know, let it dance up there and then come back with a, you know, 87 miles per hour fastball. And it's like, it looks like it's 105.
Right. Lynn is an advocate of teaching that pitch still.
Well, we have every other pitch, right? We're inventing new ones. Sweeper now is not a curve, not a slider. It's a sweeper. And I don't know how much you watch these days, Ray, but guys will elevate their changeups and sliders on purpose. That never happened, right? It was always a mistake.
Like a hanging changeup?
Oh, yeah, above the strike zone.
No. You know how far that ball would go?
Well, that's the thing. It's up,
yeah.
Right?
So that's the thing, Ray. It's elevated above the strike zone now, and it looks hittable, and you're out in front of it thinking high fastball because they wouldn't throw a changeup up there.
Maybe that's a thought.
Right? It's like fastball.
Well, because back then, wouldn't have got away with that.
That's right. And I agree, because high changeups and high hanging sliders went far.
Oh yeah. I mean, Concourse far.
Yes. And there was one guy, and you probably faced him quite a bit, Brad Radke. He might have been the forefather of the high changeup.
Yes. He was probably the only one.
Well, I'm looking at your home run log here. You hit some home runs against some of the best. Took Randy Johnson deep late in your career.
Fastballs.
Well, you know when I look at this, and I've always been, and you've heard me say this, Lynn, I'm an advocate of building a lineup. Leadoff man, number two hitter, number three, number four, guys that fit those molds, right?
Yes. Oh,
you're an elite leadoff man of your career. You fall in the footsteps of somebody like Tim Raines, who was here before you.
Yes.
And then you took over. You're a switch hitting second baseman. Tim started the career second base, went to outfield. But you're a switch hitting second baseman leadoff man that got on base, hit for power. Those were few and far between. Do you feel that you can get back? If you could get back in the game, you can be an advocate to teach players how to be leadoff hitters.
You could, but I guess would the player want to be the typical leadoff hitter?
Good point.
Because sometimes you give yourself up, like for an at bat. Like say, you know, facing a tough pitcher, you might have to see the first two pitches. So now you're in a hole.
Yep.
And now you might strike out or, you know, hit a weak ground ball somewhere, but you gave your number two, three, four hitter pitchers to see.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, it's almost like I forget about that aspect of making sure you see lots of pitches for the guys behind you.
Correct.
Yes.
Your first home run, you remember where and when and who?
Detroit.
Yes.
David Wells.
That's it. No hesitation.
I said this to Lynn, and I said, there's other things you won't remember. Do you remember your first double?
No.
Exactly.
DJ didn't either. Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I don't remember that.
I do remember one of the furthest balls I've ever seen hit in my entire life. Cecil Fielder.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Hit a ball to center field.
Swing and a miss.
And I don't think it's landed yet. I mean, center field in the old Detroit stadium was like, what?
440.
440 to dead center. And it hit the top black piece of wood up there.
Right.
That's the furthest ball I've ever seen.
That was Ray Durham with Len and DJ in the booth this past Sunday on his bobblehead day at Wright Field. Fun day all in all. And, of course, a really, really interesting trip down memory lane with Ray Ray there. One of my favorites growing up, watching him lead off for that White Sox team throughout most of the 90s, was a great second baseman and phenomenal switch hitter, which actually leads us to what is going to be our next conversation regarding switch hitting. Will optimization in baseball eventually be the death of the switch hitter? Now, I ask that somewhat rhetorically because, honestly, there are still enough good switch hitters where I don't think they'll ever go away completely. But you wonder if we'll start to see, you know, a lot less switch hitters in baseball because so few can actually be productive from both sides of the plate. You know, if your hitting coaches recognize that you're just weaker, you don't necessarily have the power on one side of the plate, will you eventually be pushed to going to your stronger side where you are whatever naturally, whether you're right-handed or left-handed, will that push more and more switch hitters out of baseball? That is the question, because you see it all around baseball. Optimization is everything. You're trying to get the best results from what your pitcher can do through tunneling, through, you know, TrackMan, everything, all the high-speed video cameras that they have now to optimize what you can do as a pitcher. You wonder, will eventually switch hitters kind of go the way of the dodo bird? And, you know, eventually, I mean, think about it. There was a day and age when there used to be left-handed catchers, and then they recognized, well, that doesn't do a whole lot of good when you're trying to keep the running game at bay. You can't have a left-handed catcher. So you wonder, now that we're getting more and more advanced with what we can do and precision in baseball, will we see less and less switch hitters? Just a question that kind of we were throwing around here back in the station, myself, Jake Santos, Brendan Riley, and of course spurred a little bit by Ray Durham and that conversation. So we have a Twitter question for you regarding switch hitters, the best in baseball. We're going to throw that around a bit here. And also coming up at 2 o'clock, The Athletic's Keith Law, who does a great job monitoring prospects, getting you ready for the Major League Baseball draft. He's going to join me at 2 o'clock as we're under a month away from the Major League Baseball draft. And, of course, the White Sox, there's a lot of optimism surrounding their farm system. So Keith Law, one of the best in the business, he's going to join me at 2 o'clock, and we're going to pick his brain about where the White Sox are at organizationally and with their farm system and what maybe they should be considering in the upcoming Major League Baseball draft. Hey, students, it's easier than ever to get your friends together for a White Sox game. Sign up for student pass alerts and get exclusive access to lower-level tickets. Text STUDENT to 244-769. That's 244-769 to sign up, or visit whitesox.com/student for more information. When we come back, we'll let you weigh in on who is the best switch hitter currently in baseball. Right here on White Sox Weekly, I'm Jeff Meller. This is the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Get weird with Waddle's World on ESPN Chicago.
The 2-2 from Gainey.
A swing and a drive. Deep left field. You can kiss that one goodbye. It's a walk-off home run. Braden Montgomery plays the hero. 8-7, the final score. A Winston-Salem winner on a walk-off solo shot to left for Braden Montgomery.
That was earlier this week. Braden Montgomery, a walk-off home run for the Winston-Salem Dash. And the reason we're playing the Braden Montgomery highlight, not just because it's White Sox Weekly, but we're talking about switch hitters. And the White Sox prospect in high A is having a fantastic season so far this year. He's already been promoted from low A to high A, and currently his minor league stats on the year, he's hitting .279 with a .362 on base and .846 OPS, 9 homers, and again, as a switch hitter. And he's better as a right-handed hitter, but not so dramatically better that you would ask him not to hit as a lefty. And in fact, as a left-handed hitter, he's actually got more home runs, although that's a product of facing less left-handed pitching. But, you know, he's 317, 362, 732 as a right-handed hitter. As a lefty, he's 270, 362, 427. So certainly somebody who at the lower levels is showing that he could be a major league switch hitter. I'm sure if he continues to progress at that, you know, somewhat similar level, he'll be a switch hitter in the major leagues. But, you know, that's the question. Is optimization in baseball eventually going to prevent a lot of players from becoming switch hitters at the major league level? Because usually one side or the other, you have more power, you're giving away a little bit at whatever is not your natural handedness. And so that's the question, which led us to ask today's Twitter poll question of the following: who is the best switch hitter in baseball currently? And the three options we came up with: Jose Ramirez, Francisco Lindor, and Ketel Marte. And the order I gave them to you are the order in which they are being voted on right now. Jose Ramirez getting 62% of the votes, 28 to Lindor, and 10% to Ketel Marte, although I suspect that not enough people have followed closely how well Ketel Marte has been over the last two-plus seasons, because he's really turned it on. And you may just be thinking of him back when he was a little bit more injury-plagued, but he's been excellent over the last two couple of seasons when he's been on the field. So that question out there for you, we will discuss that during the White Sox game when we ask Len and DJ their thoughts on that one. Up next, real quick, let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. Up next, we will chat with Keith Law of The Athletic, ask him about the White Sox farm system, get you ready for the Major League Baseball draft. Plenty to do right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Carmen and Yurko, now weekdays noon to 3.
Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Getting set for pregame coverage of White Sox and Rangers coming your way at 2:30. We've got a 3:08 first pitch. Len Casper, Darren Jackson will be along right around 3 o'clock. Right now, my pleasure to be joined by The Athletic's Keith Law. Does a fantastic job covering minor league baseball, getting you set for the Major League Baseball draft, covers the prep game, and obviously has a deep knowledge of the ins and outs of the farm systems around Major League Baseball, and he knows a thing or two about Major League Baseball as well. And if you're interested, if you're a parent, he does a great job ranking and breaking down board games as well, but we probably won't have time for that on White Sox Weekly, but another time. Keith, thanks for joining me this afternoon. Appreciate it. I want to start with the news of the day real quick, Keith, because for the White Sox, it is Noah Schultz who has been promoted from AA to AAA. He'll be playing for the Charlotte Knights here shortly. And I'm just curious as to your thoughts, because Noah Schultz, even though he's one of the top pitching prospects in all of baseball, the numbers haven't been as eye-popping as they were last year. And I'm curious as to your thoughts about what an organization, how they go about promoting a pitcher aggressively, considering maybe he hasn't had the same amount of success that he had last year.
Yeah, I was a little surprised, actually.
Me too.
He's walking far more guys than he did last year. And I just pulled up his game log just to make sure I had the most recent info. Just in his last, 5 starts, 24 innings, 17 walks, a 60% strike rate. Now, that's not just him throwing pitches in the zone. That's pitches that end up as strikes. So hitters could be chasing stuff way out of the zone, and I'm sure they are, given what his stuff looks like. That is not a guy I want to send to AAA, especially because in AAA they use the challenge system, right? So we're going to see, like, walk rates are higher in AAA, and strikeout rates, particularly called strike rates, are lower. Are you setting him up for failure? Is probably too strong a word, but something less than success by pushing him there? And what's the need? What is gained by pushing him to AAA when he's pitched less than a full season at AA and has not had quite the level of success that we were all hoping for? And I would say that's kind of across. The walk rate is the most obvious thing, but the slider hasn't been as good this year. And the fastball still doesn't really miss as many bats as you would like. So there are things he still needs to be working on, things to develop. Why bump him up another level? Unless it's just to show everybody, hey, we got this guy and we're moving him up. Look how close he is to the majors.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I saw it last night after the game, and it definitely caught me off guard because, as you just laid out the numbers, he hasn't had as much success as you would expect from a guy who you would bump up. And so it definitely perplexed me last night when I saw it, and so I was curious as to your thoughts. So I'm glad that I'm not in the, you know, completely out in left field there. You know what I'll do is the next time I get a chance to chat with Chris Getz, I'll ask him specifically what the thought process was. And I'm sure
I would love to know.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a reason. There can always be stuff. I don't have all the data that they have, and I haven't seen Schultz myself this year since spring training, so maybe there's more to it.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Keith Law joining me here on White Sox Weekly. Jeff Meller on ESPN 1000. And the one thing I'll say is that I do question myself a lot more these days, because I do feel like, specifically when it comes to pitching, with Brian Bannister and Ethan Katz heading the White Sox pitching development, I do feel like organizationally they're in a far better place than they were just a few short years ago. And so that's why I do actually say, okay, well, you know what? Maybe they have a good reason for why they're doing it, but that one definitely caught me off guard yesterday. What do you think about Brian Bannister and where the White Sox are at with their pitching development right now?
I would say, I think overall, and this would be pitching and position player development, it's almost night and day versus where they were 2+ years ago. I had heard for years that Chris Getz and his group on player development wanted to do more and were held back from doing so, largely by ownership. And I think since he became the GM, you are starting to see them just honestly just do better, just have better results. I think there's better processes to the extent that I've heard about some of these things. They definitely have better processes, but you can just see it in the results. The hitters are actually getting better for the first time in a long time. Honestly, that group, God, that Teal Montgomery trade for the Garrett Crochet trade. Yes. Maybe at some point we'll call it the Teal Montgomery trade, but I think most people would say it's the Garrett Crochet trade. Like, that looks great. Those two guys get into the system, and right away they start showing signs of immediate progress over where they were the last time we saw both of those players last year. I think we're seeing some of that on the pitching side, but it hasn't been as good of a year, too. Schultz, I think, has kind of plateaued. Hagen Smith's start has really concerned me because he's been so wild. I mean, this guy never had a picture-perfect delivery, but the walk rate he'd shown early this season, not even throwing a ton of innings, I also found pretty concerning. I mean, it's pushing to the level where, man, I don't know if this guy can start. Certainly, if he holds that for a whole year, I think that's going to be a real conversation. Is this guy even a starter? But then, you know, Grant Taylor, actually, it's funny we're talking about promoting guys too quickly. Grant Taylor is exactly the guy you bring to the big league. He could break any time. The stuff is amazing. He started pitching well, and he's throwing strikes. Boom, get him there. Absolutely, 100% on board with that. I would love to say Grant Taylor is going to be a starter at some point, but I don't have a crystal ball into how healthy he's going to be, so I totally understood that case of very aggressive promotion. So overall, I feel way more optimistic about them as an organization than I did 2 years ago.
Keith Law of The Athletic joining me here on ESPN 1000. Of course, if you're not a subscriber, I think Keith's content in itself is worth your subscription fee, but there's plenty more as well to that. So go ahead and check it out on The Athletic. Keith, you kind of led me to it. Grant Taylor, and that was something I wanted to ask you about. If you were heading an organization, like, what is the push and the pull of, okay, we've got this electric arm, and I'll bring Bannister back. Bannister threw out the other day, you know, that it is some of the best stuff he's ever seen, and he threw in the caveat, and I understand I don't throw that out there lightly. So we know what Taylor can bring to the mound, but, of course, pitching inherently brings with it so much risk. Like, when you have a guy like that, and, you know, I guess – you're worried because he had Tommy John surgery. He's had some other shoulder issues in the past, and now he's back. He's healthy. He looks great. How much value is it at the major league level to have, okay, you've got a one-inning potentially shutdown closer of the future here, but at the same time, you know, we know more and more that it's about, hey, just stack up those innings, as many as you can get from those elite arms. You want to do that, too, to optimize, you know, your AAV, if you will, your return on investment. So I guess – like, if you're running an organization, like, how do you manage that, and how should White Sox fans look at that?
So I look at Taylor. You know, Taylor was a guy when I was doing my off-season list. You know, if he's fully healthy, he's a top 100 prospect in baseball, no question. But he wasn't fully healthy. He hasn't been fully healthy for 3 years. I saw him in fall league, and he was awful. And, you know, sort of went in, he was one of my top targets to see, because I'd seen the video of the four outings he had last year when he between injuries when he was actually able to pitch. This is unbelievable. And then I saw him in fall league. I'm like, God, it's not good. And that's a pretty good sign. Like, this guy's got to be absolutely 100%. And then it's electric. But in a lot of other cases, it's going to be quite a bit less than that. And you're wondering, like, what's the optimal role for a guy like this? You know, I separate him from Smith and Schultz, who were both on my top 100 coming into the season, because both those guys have better track records of health, better track records of extended success, and projected starters, or at least did coming into the season. Whereas Taylor, as much as I loved what I saw from him in A-ball last year, I cannot, in good conscience, tell you that this guy is going to be able to hold up as a starter. He's just not done it in so many years at this point. That is a case where, you know, remember the White Sox, I always, not you need to remember, but listeners, remember, the White Sox, no way more about this guy's health and durability than any of us do. So I do kind of defer to them. Look, they think this guy just needs to come to the big leagues and work primarily in relief. I'm going to trust them on that. I would love to see them stretch him out a little bit in some of the outings. He doesn't have to be a one-inning guy. This guy does have a history of at least working as a starter. What if he's a 2-3-inning guy 2 to 3 times a week? You can manage his workload better. You can give him more time off between outings. Maybe that keeps him healthier and also goes to what you're saying. You're getting a little bit more production out of a guy with some of the best stuff in the system.
Keith Law joining me here on White Sox Weekly. Keith, it's funny because I agree with you. You mentioned, you know, maybe in the future we'll call it the Teal Montgomery trade. And the fact is they they also got Mydroth and Wickelman Gonzalez in that deal as well. And I think Chase Mydroth has blown people away who are watching daily pitch by pitch because I was talking with Dan Plesac the other day, and he said, I call him just enough. He does everything just good enough to be a really, really good baseball player. And I think, you know, some of the things that have surprised us from watching is his ability at shortstop. Like it doesn't always look pretty, but when you look at the advanced metrics, he's getting it. He's saving a lot of runs. And then his approach at the plate is just, it's probably the, honestly, the, I give him more credit than any of the veterans on the team, the way he approaches each at bat. And so it's really surprising to see him have this much success. Obviously the league will adjust and he'll have to adjust to that. But are you surprised with how well Chase Mydroth has kind of ingrained himself so quickly on this White Sox roster?
I'm shocked by the defense because it's not pretty. I saw him a couple times last year and like nice player, ugly swing, ugly defense, but elite plate zone discipline, right? Just knows balls from strikes, picks up pitches well, but really just understands the strike zone at about as high a level as you're going to see and can do just enough with everything else with in terms of his back control, in terms of how hard he hits the ball to sort of give him enough overall value. I am really stunned. I actually just pulled up Baseball Savant to see if he really that playing that well at shortstop. Yeah, he's plus 4 runs above average, I think, in a small sample. And defensive metrics, you need a pretty large sample to really believe in them.
Yeah.
But the fact that he's positive at all is shocking. He's not that kind of athlete. He's not super twitchy. Didn't look like a plus defender. It's like, that guy's going to play second or third, get on base a ton. Maybe he's a regular, maybe he's a really good utility player.
Yeah.
Seems like that was a little bit light. You know, if he can be an average shortstop, that's a regular for a long time.
No doubt about it. And again, the plate discipline, I'll tell you, it's been somewhat infectious because you look at, like, I have to get the exact date, but over the last, it's been about a month, the White Sox have led all of baseball in walks, which for a team that was in, which for a team that was in dead last, Keith, for like the last 3 years counting, to go a month where you're leading all of baseball in walks, it was like, it's just a shock to the system. So even though the record doesn't necessarily reflect it, it's definitely a different team than it was that lost 121 last year. So that's the positive for White Sox fans, where you can take something from what they're doing. And I think that, again, goes to what we're talking about with the entire organization. Keith Law joining me here on White Sox Weekly. Keith, I'm curious, you're locked in to all of these prep players, the farm systems. Honestly, I don't have enough time and bandwidth usually to walk into college, but this time of year during the College World Series, you know, on the second screen, I'll monitor it. How closely do you watch the College World Series? We've got a great one coming up with LSU Arkansas tonight, including one of the top prospects who I believe is pitching in that game. How do you consume College World Series with all of your other duties?
Not a lot, honestly, because like Murray State's an awesome story. Mm-hmm. Don't have any prospects. Coastal Carolina, another awesome story. They have one prospect. And on it, sometimes watching those games is not, certainly not the way I would consume a game when I'm actually there and trying to evaluate a player. Now, LSU Arkansas probably have on in the background because there's like 7 guys for this year and a couple guys for next year. And it's going to be just, I expect a great game. It's 2 of the best teams in the country. If you ask me to, who would I bet on to win it all? I kind of want to say Arkansas, being a little sentimental because they've never won, but they're loaded. I saw them this year against Vanderbilt and they were just stacked top to bottom, pitching, hitting, fielding. That's just a really, really great team. So would certainly love to see them make a deep run here. But in terms of watching them, it, like I said, it's pretty hit or miss. And I'm actually looking at the teams. I think all of them. I didn't see Coastal because there's just one guy, and really, I don't ever need to go to Myrtle Beach again for the rest of my life. But I think I saw everybody else who mattered there. So it would just be kind of like, get a quick check. Did it still look the same? Is Cade Anderson still throwing like he did when I saw him throw a complete game shutout at Oklahoma in early April? Just to kind of make sure everyone's all arms and legs are still attached.
Last thing for you, Keith, as I let you go, and thank you for your time. I always appreciate it. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Cade Anderson there. He will be starting tonight. I'm curious, the White Sox are picking 10th. A couple of names that you think might be there and on the board for them that you think would be potential players who could be selections for them in the upcoming draft.
Yeah, well, Cade Anderson, you know, if you'd asked me a month ago, I would have said Anderson would be a perfect fit. And now I feel like there's no chance he gets to them. I did a mock draft the other day. I gave them Tyler Bremner, who's one of the top right-handers in the draft. Came into the year as maybe the top one. Elite changeup, throws a ton of strikes. Rough start to the season, but he did right the ship as the year went on. There's some mechanical stuff I think they need to work on. The White Sox are comfortable taking guys like that. I think they would take Seth Hernandez, who's the top high school pitcher in the draft. I'm not a fan of taking high school pitchers in the first round just because the track record is poor, but White Sox obviously are very comfortable doing that. And just two other names I've heard them with specifically. Steele Hall, who's a 17-year-old shortstop from Alabama, maybe the fastest guy in the draft, certainly one of them, and has some power, stays it short, issues hitting breaking stuff. And the other is Cruz Schoolcraft, who's a 6'8 lefty from out in Oregon, who's been up to 97, 98, also a really good changeup. Questions about how well he can spin it. He'll flash it from time to time, but he's not really found a consistent above-average breaking ball. But, I mean, he's 6'8 and he throws really hard. Some people just can't walk past that, and I totally understand.
Keith, I appreciate it. Great stuff, as always. I will be reading, and I encourage anybody who doesn't have a subscription to check out Keith Law on The Athletic. Does great work and has been doing so for years. As always, appreciate it, my man.
Thank you.
That was Keith Law, again, of The Athletic. Hey, Sox fans, learn from the pros this summer at a White Sox summer camp presented by Wintrust. Starting at $165, kids aged 5 through 12 can register for a four-day baseball camp offered at over 35 locations throughout the Chicagoland area. Campers will receive a swag bag with a custom sliding mitt, pack of Topps baseball cards, and more. To learn more, visit whitesox.com/play. This is White Sox Week.
Follow Chicago's Home for Sports on Twitch, ESPN 1000 Chicago.
Back here on White Sox Weekly, ahead of White Sox and Rangers, pregame coverage begins in under 10 minutes from now at 2:30. It will be game number 2 of a 3-game series in Texas, in Arlington, to be more specific, at Globe Life Field. Connor McKnight, formerly in this chair, the previous pre- and post-game host of White Sox Baseball. I am Jeff Meller, now in that role. Connor now works for CHSN, and he had a good conversation getting to know Kyle Teal, and that's what this was like earlier this week.
Sitting down with Kyle Teal, who is celebrating 1 week in the bigs. Were you aware that it's been a week, 7 days today?
I haven't. It's gone by really quick.
Yeah, so that's kind of like, what does it feel to know it's been a week? Like, what do you know now about being a big leader that you had no idea you were going to learn?
Yeah, I mean, you're just around so much talent and so many great competitors, so I'm just trying to be a sponge, learn as much from the pitching staff as I can, and just take in as much information as I can that might help me.
You've been talked about some by like guys like Davis, you know, veterans on this team. You've not just been a sponge. You kind of offered some ideas, especially back behind the plate. What does it feel like to know that your input is kind of valued when it comes to your gig?
Yeah, I mean, it's great to know that the pitching staff trusts me and that the numbers I call, you know, they're going to listen. And you know, I think it's most important that they throw what they want, but I feel like I come up with a good game plan to help us win every day.
Have you been able to exhale yet? You know, just kind of take it all in and relax some? Your job is ridiculous as a catcher. You've got so much homework to do.
Yeah. I mean, like, today I have an off day. Obviously ready to come in late innings, but, like, just being able to chill a little bit pregame, it's nice. At the same time, you know, I love playing every day.
Yeah.
This is what I love to do. So, I love playing the game, and this has just been like a baseball vacation.
But it's a good vacation to spend, right?
Yes.
What do you find yourself like? So you had like what, an extra hour and a half today? Like, what do you find yourself downshifting to do? I know there's a chessboard in the room. Guys are getting into that.
Getting ready for the Rangers,
right?
I watched some chess, being played. I'm a big chess guy.
Really?
Yeah, I play chess every day on chess.com.
This is an ad for chess.com.
But, yeah, I mean, big chess guy.
Do you have a rating? Do you have a chess rating?
I do.
Rating?
I'm like a 900.
All right. Is that good or bad?
It's like average, I would say. I would say like the average chess player is like a 700, so I'm like slightly above average.
All right.
I kind of throw games a little bit, hang my queen a few times, but...
Oh, you hate hanging a queen.
Yeah.
That's no good.
Yep.
All right. Next time around, we're not promising anything now. Next time around, we'll give out the chess.com gamer tag. White Sox fans
sure.
to play a little
For
bit.
For sure.
Right.
Yeah, we'll get after it.
We'll see if that happens. Kyle Teal.
There you go, Kyle Teal sitting down with Connor McKnight earlier this week. Now, no off day for him today. He is in the lineup DHing, I guess off day for him from behind the plate. But he'll get his first dose of Jacob deGrom. So have fun with that, young grandmaster Kyle Teal. That is going to do it for us on White Sox Weekly here today. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Want to say thanks to Davis Martin for joining us, Jesse Rogers, and Keith Law as well. Fun conversation. If you missed any of it, go ahead and check out the podcast. It's available for you on the ESPN Chicago app. That's going to do it for us here on White Sox Weekly, but don't go anywhere. White Sox pregame coverage starts next right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.